You are listening to Radio Albion.
Christ is risen. This is Easter Sunday, 2025, and this is another edition of the Russian Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and like most people listening, you should be in somewhat of a good mood. I am too. One of the reasons I'm in a good mood is because sometimes I actually stop and think about the people who have thought enough of my work here, its originality, and sent me money. There's a whole bunch of you out there, from a dollar to, you know, there is no limit. I'm telling you, there is no limit. And it's the only way, really, that I could function, whether it be through book sales or the Patreon, direct donations. There's a million ways to do it. And once in a while, it really occurs to me just how powerful of a message that is, and I'm very humbled by it, especially given the day. And so for all of you, I want to thank you. And for those who are simply unable, things will get better. Most of you know the condition I was in, 10 years ago? And everything has turned around, thanks be to God. And that's what Poshka is. So we will remain on a very important religious topic. You know, I've always been a political animal, a historical animal. And in fact, this topic, if I'm not mistaken, was my very first major revisionist publication when I worked for Willis Cardo at the Barnes Review. And it concerns Ivan the Terrible. Ivan the Fourth of Russia, who ruled, one of the longest ruling monarchs of all time, from 1533 to 1584. A great man. Most, you know, like Rasputin, most people don't realize that. Like a lot of great men, he was thrust in an extremely difficult position, and in his case, at a very young age. But specifically, the claim is made that he ordered the murder of Metropolitan St. Philip of Moscow, Philip II of Moscow. Now, if you've read the description, you know that, of course, I'm going to refute that, and I've been refuting this for many years. I was refuting it in graduate school. Now, apart from the fact that Peter and Catherine and the Annas slaughtered bishops, tortured them to death in huge numbers, and they're included in the Sunday of Orthodoxy as Orthodox monarchs, despite none of them being Orthodox whatsoever, and certainly not behaving that way. Ivan the Terrible is somehow, and for some reason, singled out for the alleged murder of a great man, St. Philip. It's going to take a while to go through. This is one of these problems that I know too much. So I need to be very careful. My daily nationalist is now over an hour. I just have given up. It's not going to change. So I'm going to deal with, two things. The Opalchina and what it is and how it functioned, because that's immediately connected to this claim that Ivan was a, you know, paranoid murderer and specifically murdered a bishop of the church, which was like a hobby for the so-called monarchs in the 18th century. So on January 3rd, 1565, a messenger galloped to Moscow. He had two royal charters. One of them he handed to Metropolitan Afanasy, And it described all the betrayals, the rebellions, the disorder of the oligarch, the boyar government. He complained that it was impossible to serve the Tsar in such conditions, to serve Russia in such conditions. Not wanting to endure many treasonous deeds, we left the state out of great pity of heart and went where God would show us the way. So you have not just Tsar Ivan leaving power, or at least seemingly, you have others doing so too. And the others, the other one was addressed to the Moscow common people. Ivan declared that Russia should have no doubt about him, and that he, while he is resigning, he's not angry at them. The common people, ordinary people, are not the problem. So the first, that Ivan the Terrible can't rule anymore. He can't do it anymore. It's too stressful. It's too evil. And the second, to the common people, that they are not at fault. Now, he didn't abdicate the throne. That was simply impossible. Nicholas II didn't either. But this was a request. Do you want me to continue? It was a dramatic moment. The great historian Kluczewski wrote, "Everything froze. The capital instantly interrupted its usual activities. Shops closed, offices emptied, songs fell silent." Well, it seems strange to do something like this, but it's actually a very specifically Russian thing. The capital then came alive with popular gatherings, and the people cried, "The Tsar has abandoned us, really? Who will be our protector against the foreigners? How could sheep be without a shepherd?" Clergy, boyars, dignitaries, officials, crying, demanding that Metropolitan Afanasy appease Ivan, sparing no one, fearing nothing. The chant was, "The Tsar execute the villains, the anti-Russian forces. Life and death are his will. But let not the kingdom remain without a head. He is our ruler, according to the chronicle. Given by God, we know no other. We all go after you with our heads to beat our foreheads and weep." The merchants and townsmen, specific estates, they specifically said, "Let the Tsar show us traitors. We ourselves will destroy them." Well, the Metropolitan wanted to go to the Tsar immediately, but the General Council decided that the bishop should remain to guard because the capital itself was in great confusion. So here we have Ivan the Terrible threatening to resign because the people around him, he simply can't. It is so stressful. The oligarchs, the confusion. I don't know who to trust. I can't do it. And as one body, everything stopped. Word spreads very quickly. So they chose St. Pimen of Novgorod, or Commandrite Levki of the Chudov Monastery, as ambassadors. A whole bunch of others went after them. Nicander of Rostov, Eleutherius of Suzdal, Volothius of Ryazan, etc. A whole bunch of our Commandrites, that of the Troitsky and Spassky monasteries. An entire train of clergy, nobles, the princes like Ivan Belsky and Ivan Mstislavsky, with everybody they could, directly from the Metropolitan's chambers. They didn't even stop at their home. They went straight to him. Clearly, they had made their choice, and it was a unanimous democratic one. Consciously and unequivocally, they freely expressed their consent to serve together with the Tsar in the work of God. The house of the Holy Mother of God was what Ivan the Terrible wanted to do. And he understood this. And on February 2nd, 1565, he solemnly returned to Moscow and began to organize the country. Now, I start off with this to show you what the situation was and what kind of a man Ivan was. He had no problem with resigning. He didn't like it. But only if the people unanimously said, "You stay," will he continue. Well, his first step in his war against the oligarchy was the establishment of the Opochnina. Now, had existed the term Opochnina had existed a long time. It initially referred to the remainder of an estate that was sufficient to support, you know, the widow and orphans of a soldier who had fallen in battle or died in service. The estate was granted by the Grand Duke for service usually, went to the treasury, except for that plot necessary to maintain who was left. This was interesting. Ivan brought cities, lands, even streets in Moscow under the Opochnina jurisdiction. That means they were transferred to the personal and unconditional management of the Tsar himself. These regions were to provide material support for the Opochniks, the core of the Tsar's associates, his colleagues, in trying to rebuild Russia. Roughly, the Opochnina was mostly around Novgorod, not huge. The opposite of the Opochnina was the Zemshchina, the normal way of government. Sometimes new territories were added to the Opochnina. But the point of this now was to bring a certain portion near Novgorod under the personal direct control of the monarch. It became a tool in the hands of the Tsar. So to speak, he sifted all of Russian society. He was at war with heresy, vice, and more importantly, the oligarchy of boyars that was forming, and that actually was formed. His headquarters was at the Alexandrovskaya Sloboda. Became the heart of the battle for the soul of Russia. It's about 100 miles north of Moscow. It was an extremely intense and full religious movement. The Sloboda was arranged like a monastery. It had chambers and cells, a beautiful church. A church built, each of its bricks was imprinted with the cross. The Tsar and his opichniks zealously and strictly followed a strict charter, a monastic charter that Ivan had drawn up. So the Opochnina became a form of ascetic obedience. This was his weapon, the struggle for the Orthodox Church without reserve. He didn't care about class or anything. He didn't demand nobility or wealth. He demanded loyalty only. And he said, talking about the horrible conditions that he had to deal with, "It happened because of my sins that our princes and boyars began to betray us, and we, the sufferers, brought you closer, wanting service and truth from all of you." The opichniks would ride with the dogs' heads and brooms tied to their saddles, at least according to Karamzin. It was a symbol that they were gnawing at the Tsar's enemies and sweeping Russia clean. It was a turning point not just for Ivan, but for Russian history. It was never very large, but its regiments were involved in repelling the raids of Dzhivlikarei in 1571 and 1572 from Crimea. Conspiracies of the oligarchs in Novgorod and Pskov were exposed and neutralized by them. The purpose of the oligarchs was to separate Russia from Lithuania, and in Novgorod in particular, the Judaizers were still there, which is a whole separate issue, but the Opochnina was a way of life, it was a region, and it also referred to a group of men who would do anything to cleanse the country. And if that didn't happen, Ivan said, "I can't rule anymore." Now, as far as the rest of the country, Ivan placed the Kasimov Tsar, Simeon Bekbulatovich, someone who Ivan trusted was a very small circle, who initially was a Muslim, a Tartar, who converted. He was there only from 1575 and 1576. He was placed at the head of the Zemshchina parts of Russia. Now, Western scholars, both then and now, I mean, it's not just a new thing. This is all a big mystery to them. Can you imagine a non-Orthodox liberal scholar in Manhattan trying to make sense out of all this? Well, they don't do a very good job. They come up with all kinds of theories. One of them is that they wanted to take lands away from the church without being blamed, which he did. It's a theory that I don't think they thought through completely, since it was very clear what was going on. There was nothing secret here. Just like yesterday's historians, today's scribblers, they went over everything. Political treachery, court intrigue. Some of them just said it's just the whim of a tyrant. They failed to think of the simplest explanation that this man really did rule the rest of the country. Like Prince Robodanovsky did in the absence of Peter. Because the Tsar was focused on the Opochnina regions. It was almost a division of powers. Simeon did get the title of Grand Prince of all Russia. Ivan, outside of the Opochnina, called himself simply Ivan Vasilev. And in doing so, it seems he was denouncing the insignificance of titles, the regalia of power. The only thing that mattered was heavenly election to royal service. It affirmed the crushing responsibility of the Russian Tsar before God. Human titles are meaningless. Russia lived under God's laws, not man's. Ivan was the Tsar regardless of any title or where he lived or what he did. That apparently is beyond historians over the last 300 years. So this concept, there's nothing mysterious about it. Really, because you know, liberals and nominalists and Jews don't understand the relation between the nation and crown, and not just in Russia, but other Orthodox countries, the ethnos and the Tsar. These are extra-legal relations based on the division of duties. It's a family metaphor rather than a state in the modern sense. Like most traditional societies, it was an estate system. Each estate, this is not connected with income. Actually, most of the so-called nobility in Russia was very poor and very put on. But each estate, each, you know, guild, each necessary aspect of society had rights and duties that were spelled out. This was a matter of religious service. It was Christian, you know, differing forms of the Christian service common to everybody. And this is how our soul will be saved in the world. He struggled to make this the center of everything. But nothing was going to change unless the Opochnina or something like it was founded. The Kievan and even post-Kievan period of the Apanage princes, princes who ruled without any reference to a monarch over them. Of course, that system was long gone, but those families remained very powerful. These aren't service nobles that were dependent on the monarchy. No, this was an oligarchy to themselves. Mechnicheństwo, or localism, was the foundation of oligarchy. A powerful family would rule a large estate, and that would be the base to take over state power. Mutual responsibility was the concept. It doesn't seem all that harmful, but it's based on the concept of the social contract, the intrinsic value and equality of the participants in this relationship. No, that is not the Orthodox understanding. That leads to isolation, division, faction, and then to class or estate enmity, cutting the body of the nation in to pieces. It is not the responsibility before each other that divides the nation, but the common struggle, the conciliar, to Bodernost. That responsibility before God, that is, according to Ivan, the basis of Russian life. How many times have I said that every nation on earth has a choice to make? Either it follows the path of the republic, the oligarchy, liberal democracy, some variation of that where the ego is enshrined, or the common good, which usually means a military government, strong leadership, strong executive, or usually a monarchy. The common responsibility, not mutual responsibility. It equalizes everyone in a single Orthodox service, a single concept of duty, a single faith and mutual love, which is commanded and implied by the phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. The Tsar's motto, so to speak, was humble everyone in love. Because before God, man has no rights, only duties that we all have. And that understanding unites the ethnos into a single conciliar personality with one mouth and one heart, as he would say, calling out to God. The Tsars is in a special position given all of this. He's anointed by the church, and he testifies and answers to the piety of the people's public life. That's where the kingdom of God and man are symbolically united, in the same sense as Christ's body united the divine and human natures. In his royal service, the Tsar is not of this world. Before him, everyone is equal, and no one has any privileges or special rights except one duties to their station, their estate. There was a collection of miscellany in the second half of the 16th century, and within it, it's like sayings of powerful people. And one of them says, by his bodily nature, the Tsar is like every man. By his power of rank, he is like God. For he has nothing higher on earth than himself. It befits the Tsar, as a mortal, not to be arrogant, and like God, not to be angry. When the prince is blameless in all his character, then can he both torment and forgive all peoples with meekness. That's the understanding. I mean, if you want to boil it down, that's the understanding of royal power that Ivan tried to impose on Russia, the very opposite of the boyar oligarchy that was developing, that tormented him as a very young man. And he took power at a very young age, and of course had a regency, and of course had nothing but resentment towards him. The great historian, Kluchevsky, writes, I'm going to quote him directly here from the Russian. By the middle of the 15th century, the Moscow Grand Prince was surrounded by a dense wall of noble boyar families. Since then, in all branches of Moscow government, in the State Duma as advisors, in the orders as judges, that is ministers, in the regions as governors, in the regiments as voivodes, all princes and leaders, following their princes, the Rostov, Yaroslav, Ryazan boyars, went to Moscow. I like this idea of a wall of noble boyar families. The wall was between the Tsar and the estates. These are the men who actually wanted to rule, and as we know, were able to take over in the 18th century. So the aggravation here was that the service princes leaving the abolished upon us thrones that dominated during the Kiev and early Moscow periods. Now, of course, there's nothing bad in that. But it implies a unification of Great Russia and the elevation of the Moscow Grand Prince to the level of the national sovereign and Roman Emperor. Unfortunately, for some, they were very resentful of this. A boyar served in Moscow, and belonging to the class meant for him, first of all, he had to recognize his corresponding duties. Relations with the Grand Duke of Moscow, say, in the 14th century, early 15th, were proper. I mean, this is the era of Simeon the Proud, who wrote in Moscow, he said, we would listen in everything to our father, Vladika Alexei, and the old boyars who wanted good for our father and for us. Now, he said that in his spiritual testament to his heirs, Metropolitan, the boyars, next to each other in importance. Dmitry Donskoy, the same thing. Addressing his children, he said, love your boyar. Give them the honor they deserve for their service and do nothing without their will. This is an aspect of the symphony of powers. But in Ivan's time, this had changed. The boyars were being reinforced and replenished with the older titled appanage nobility, very different. They brought to Moscow the concept of their hereditary rights without any reference to the crown. This is the particularism that destroyed the Kievan state. They threatened to destroy the harmony of national life. That harmony is based on the service of the estates to a common cause. Again, Kluchevsky writes, even under Ivan the Terrible, before the Opochnina, there were landowners from the highest nobility who ruled and judged without appeal on their vast estates without even reporting to the Tsar. Well, the Tsar was a person who concentrated in himself the full responsibility for what was happening in the country. Now, the number of these Boyar families was small, maybe 300, but they were powerful. They were arrogant. Again, different from the service nobility who had their lands dependent on service. They were the creations of the Moscow monarchy. But their small numbers shouldn't be reason for dismissal. They were becoming an oligarchy, and of course they were infecting other nobles. Now, Russia didn't really have a formal title nobility, but we use the word noble because it just makes sense. But for a while, there was an interregnum when Ivan the Terrible was just a little boy. They started to get extremely arrogant. They loved the idea they didn't have anyone to answer to. That means, at some point, the Opochina was absolutely essential. Men he could trust. Absolutely trust, take over the functions of government that traditionally belonged to the old Boyar class. They had to be removed. They were also regionalists. They had every intent of handing over places like Pskov and Novgorod to the Poles, so long as they got to keep their estates and didn't have to work. And that's what the Opochina was. Now, their lands were not tremendous. It was quite few. About 1,000 landowners total in the Novgorod region were transferred from the lands taken to the Opochina to other places. Usually rebels from the Novgorod region. But it also wasn't exclusively an anti-Boyar instrument. In his decrees, Ivan made it clear that he didn't... It was a matter of virtue and vice, not rank or class. Loyalty and self-sacrifice and orthodoxy, this is what mattered. So this wasn't anything sudden. This was a logical conclusion of the battle that had been brewing for some time. Ivan had to answer to God for what was going on in his country. Monarchy, at least in some part, rests on the idea that anyone who wants power shouldn't have it. As Marcus Aurelius would say, power is awful. Unless you're a sociopath, of course. Otherwise, power is awful. It is crushing. And you seem alone with all of it. Every aspect of policy affects everything else, and you're responsible for it all. His first attempts are associated with the priest Sylvester and Alexei Adashev. They ended up betraying him. Adashev really didn't belong to the Boyar class. He was actually the son of an insignificant clerk. We only hear about him the first time in February of 1547 at the royal wedding, as what the Russians call a muvnik, uloznichi. He made the royal bed and accompanied the newlyweds to the bathhouse. Ivan granted Adashev a much higher rank and said, "Alexei, I took you from among the poor." This is a direct quote from Ivan. "From among the weakest of people. I've heard your good deeds. Now I have sought you beyond your measure for the sake of helping my soul. Do not be afraid of the strong and glorious elite. Consider everything carefully and bring us truth, fearing only the judgment of God. Choose truthful judges from the boyars and nobles." He was one of the people who Ivan thought he could trust. There were many people who were given the job of bringing members of that class under royal control. It failed, so the Opochina then had to become far more militant. Or maybe, he should have simply abolished the Boyar Duma and things like that, filling it with nationalist and orthodox content. But he didn't do that. This wasn't a revolution. This was a restoration. Ivan the Terrible was extremely pious. He would travel distant monasteries to repent and pray for even fairly minor sins. He saw power as a crushing burden. People like Adashev and Sylvester, the Boyar elite were very easily able to draw them to themselves. Adishev intervened in the court intrigues around the Zakharians, the relatives of Anastasia, the Tsar's wife at the time. In fact, even arguing that you shouldn't have a centralized single Russian army, which of course the boyars hated, in favor of the old noble muster. And Sylvester was no better. They were easily corrupted. I mentioned those two because they're very famous and they're examples of Ivan's early failures. Now, what would happen if these boyars and the regionalists and the oligarchs had become successful? Had been successful, we all know the answer to that. The monarchy wouldn't exist. I don't think Russia would exist. It would be a bunch of small states, easily dominated by outsiders. Something along the lines of the worst aspects of Kiev and Rus, with much stronger neighbors. He would be a figurehead. It's either the oligarchy of you know what we call the regime today, or the common good. It can't be both, and not just in Russia. Russia was heading down this Republican route. It's a referee that could, you know, mediate conflicting interests of various social groups, given minimal power but blame for everything. He could not answer to God for that. In 1556, his decree was that all landowners, I don't care who you are, I don't care how big or small you're holding, you are now service people dedicated to both the church and the state. It was a matter of equalizing the wealthy and the poor in noble service, which was a huge group of people. Sorry about that. That was a train. I have a train right in front of my house, which I absolutely love, but not right this second. Ultimately, it comes down to the Republican ego, liberal democratic ego, the postmodern ego, or the common good of the monarchy. And Ivan, many monarchs, have known that. And it doesn't matter what era it is, it doesn't matter what age it is. And it's everything that goes along with that. The idea of the opportunum is the opposite of oligarchy. It's the core of royalism. Ivan says, I am the Tsar by God's will and not by the rebellious desire of man. He is not a boyar Tsar. He's beyond class. He's not even the Tsar of the whole nation. He is the anointed of God that has those responsibilities. And the opportunity became the instrument of asserting this conception. Again, as I said, in the 18th century, a rapacious oligarchy did take over. And then again in the 1990s, you know precisely what that leads to. The best men were brought into that fairly small body of the Obuchino, people who had a direct relationship to the life of the sovereign. And it was very difficult to trust people. By March of 1573, the Obuchino court had 1,854 men. Of these, 654 made up his security corps, his guard. And this comes actually from the testimony of foreigners. Taub and Cruz, who are opponents of the Tsar, they mention 500 to 800 men of the special opportunity. They served as a trusted envoys. They had, you know, security, intelligence, investigative, even punitive functions. Boris, the son of Gudinov, was a preachnik too. 1,200 were divided into four orders. The Postelny, who were in charge of the maintenance of the palace premises, the household. The Brony, the armory. Konyushin, in charge of the enormous horse farm, the palace, and the royal guard. And the Stini, which essentially is food and agriculture. At its height, the Opuchina never was larger than 5,000 men. Despite its small size, it played a huge role, as I mentioned already, in their battles against the Crimeans, specifically the Battle of Molodi in 1572. The Tartars were routed. Deva Mirza was captured. It was far beyond, you know, it wasn't even political, it was deeply religious. And it was something that a leader would do at a time of emergency. I'll give you an example here. 1577, during the Livonian War, the Tsar sent a Prince Mikhail Nosdravti and A.E. Saltykov to the city of Smiltynia, which today is in Latvia. Germans and Lithuanians there had occupied the city, refusing to leave, refusing to surrender. So he sent those two men. According to the great Russian historian, they did not carry any business near the city, did not report to the sovereign about what the Lithuanians were telling them from the city. The sovereign sent them to visit the boyar's son, Prona Volokirev, and he came to them at night. He had no guards. And Prince Mikhail and Andrei Saltykov's regiments and riflemen ran away from the noise, ran away from their duties. Hurrying for no one, they stopped after. Pronium came to the sovereign and told him everything in truth, that they were standing carelessly. They weren't doing anything. They weren't obeying order. This was a sad situation. So a very well-known opritchnik, Dimenshu Chedemisinov, investigated this. He was the one who, you know, finally understood what was going on. They did very little according to the sovereign's order. But those guys were even, they were going to seize the property if they left the city. And he restored order very quickly. The Opuchina did. He released the Lithuanians from the city in peace. In other words, the military men that the Tsar sent were intensely corrupt and maybe even were speaking with their enemies in the Livonian War. The Opuchina was sent to find out the truth, and the offending men were beaten with whips. Not killed them, of course. He simply sent them away. So, in many cases, military operations had to be taken out of the hands of the very same boyars that didn't like him and transferred to his, albeit very small, new elite corps. In fact, examples like that were very common. Outside of the Opuchina, the elite and their various duties were not doing their job. And they weren't doing it to the point where it was a major security concern. But over time, the boyars, with the help of the Opuchina, were cured of their class arrogance. Its long-term existence wasn't really even intended. Ivan says this about his movement. He says, "What I have done with the Opuchina is at the discretion of my children, Ivan and Fyodor, as is more profitable for them. So let them do it. The model has been made for them. They say, I have shown you how it should be done to the best of my ability, and the choice of specific methods of action is up to you. I will not restrict you in any way." And unfortunately, of course, the oligarchs were not completely cured. During the reign of Fyodor Ivanovich, who died in 1598, and of course Boris Godunov, who died in 1605. Now, the death of Ivan was a boon to them. This egomania, typical of oligarchs, the unwillingness to join the national cause. And then, of course, this is after Ivan's death, September of 1610, during the Russo-Polish War. Fearing a popular rebellion, the boyar elite secretly let the occupiers into Moscow at night. They were going to give the whole country over. 800 German troops and 3,500 Polish soldiers under Gunsevsky. And it's not the only time they were willing to give Moscow over. This was part of the ultimately the first time of troubles. Now, when I say oligarchs, I don't necessarily mean an elite. Every movement has to have an elite. We're not equals. That's not what I'm talking about. It's not their, as Ivan himself said, it's not their wealth or power. It's really in the attitude. Power for power's sake, money for money's sake. People brought under the influence of the Jews and the Judaizers in places like Novgorod were hotbeds for this. Oligarchy isn't just a plutocracy. Oligarchy is the opposite of an aristocracy. An aristocracy is very different. That's a legitimate elite. But whether we're talking about the 1990s or the time of troubles, everything begins with the fact that what was supposed to be an aristocracy became confused in its self-awareness. It lost its feeling of unity with the national body. And of course, in the case of the Jews, they had no connection with that body at all. Now, eventually, the Oprichnina ended. The Zemshchina and the Oprichnina eventually merged. Ivan did the best he could. Zemensky Sobor was called, first of which was convened by Ivan at the beginning of his reign in 1550. The Sobor here, that was a council of reconciliation. The point was to smooth over the hardships of oligarchic rule. And he made sure that the people there came from all ranks of society. The broader point, of course, is that these huge numbers that Tsar Ivan allegedly killed are simply impossible with a group that never got larger than 5,000, and only 1,000 or 2,000 at the most combat ready. We all know official history is usually incorrect. It serves the broader liberal and Jewish agenda, and Ivan the Terrible is no exception. It's like Hitler or North Korea. You could invent whatever you want. No one's going to say anything. But the Soviet historian, Skrinnikov, R.G. Skrinnikov, he said that over this long reign, 60 years, 3,500 people fell victim to the, quote, Tsarist terror. 30 years passed from the establishment of the Oprichnina until the death of Ivan. Was that 100 executions a year, including criminal offenders? No one who knows anything about Russia is going to deny that there were conspiracies all over in the wealthier regions of the West. The boyar Fedorov was a conspiracy in roughly around 1568. The point was to surround the Oprichnina during the Livonian War, kill them, and hand over Ivan to the Polish king. Even there, once they were caught, Ivan spared them. These so-called executions of 1570, there was a foreigner, Albert Schlichting, certainly had no reason to downplay the scale. He says that in this conspiracy, 300 were brought out for execution. But Ivan, even on the day of their execution, only 116 were executed, the rest pardoned and released at the last minute. The total number was 120. The tale of Ivan the Terrible and the merchant Karatan Bulin has come down a list at the end of the 16th century. That says only 7 were executed. The messenger came from the Tsar ordering that everyone else be released. What's the investigation I'm talking about here? Well, that conspiracy, the Novgorod and Pskov cases of attempts to leave Moscow and go into subjection to the Poles. You can't do any worse than that. Typical oligarch behavior. They didn't want to have to work. They didn't want to have to, you know, pay more to defend Russia. The Polish king said, oh, you don't have to worry about it. We'll increase your lands here. Well, Poland was an oligarchy. But the few that he did execute were sent out at the expense of the treasury for inclusion in the synodicons, the memorial lists, Russian monasteries. He hated the fact that he had to do this. And he fasted massively for executions. Not that he didn't deserve it, but for the situation that caused him to have to do it in the first place. Today, though, if you go on Wikipedia, it's called the Novgorod Massacre. And the truth is, the Tsar's entire personal life was ascetic, as I've already mentioned. The Tsar wasn't a big fan of Moscow. It was very bustling. It was very large. The Alexandrovka Sloboda was a place for meditation. He didn't really care for court life. You know how bad it can be. But this was what he thought was the ideal. It was a monastery within the world. A few hundred of the closest oprichniks made up the brethren. The abbot of all Russia, as Ivan called himself. the Tsar wanted, you know, when we started off by talking about Ivan's desire to resign. Well, he had every intent because he wanted to be a monk. In fact, he wanted to take monastic vows more than once. The death of his son in 1581, he did not kill him. Only the unanimous pleas of those around him kept him from doing it. Even the Opichnik brethren wore the skufia, and they wore black cassocks. The charter written by the Tsar himself, regular services. So now, I know this was a very long introduction, but all of this is necessary to understand the claim the Tsar murdered the Metropolitan Philip. I want to repeat myself. Peter the Great, the Annas, Catherine II, they sent hundreds of bishops to the rack. So why they picked this out, you know, it shows you the agenda at work here. Now, there's four sources that say that basically, I don't even know if that's true. The language can be very ambiguous. There's four primary sources. The various local chronicles, the memoirs of people I've already mentioned, Johann Taub and Iler Kruse, the writings of the disgraced Prince Andrei Kerbsky, and the Vitae of Metropolitan Philip II of Moscow, which was written at Solovyetsky. Every one of these was written by people who were clearly enemies of the Tsar. The Novgorod Third Chronicle, reporting under the summer of 7077, the strangulation of St. Philip, calls him the miracle worker of all Russia, which is odd, because they're already referring to him as a canonized saint. The entry, of course, was added much later. The Mazurin Chronicle, 1570, there was many volumes, this is volume 31, reporting on the death of Metropolitan Philip, directly refers to his vitae, which was compiled no earlier, well, the very end of the 16th century. The difference between the event and the chronicle entries of all of these, roughly 30 years at a minimum. Taub and Kruse were enemies. Their slanderous intent is very clear. The Soviet historian I mentioned above, Skirinkov, he says this about it. Eyewitnesses of the events, Taub and Kruse, compiled a lengthy but a very tendentious account of the events 4 years after the trial, meaning the trial of Philip. Well, the moral character, they were political rogues. Very difficult to listen to them. They exaggerate many things. They are political adventurers. Soviet historians, of all people, say that that's true. His vitae, The Life of St. Philip, was written roughly 20 years after his death. There's a lot of inconsistencies and problems. Many of his speeches likely were never uttered. The author wrote them. There's a speech in there trying to convince the Tsar not to establish the Opichnina. They mentioned that you know, the writer of the Vitae was not, I mean, he had literary talent, but he got carried away. There's no evidence that Philip, because of the agreement that the two of them had, Ivan and Philip, by the way, were childhood friends. There's no way, even on the best of terms, there's no way to justify the details of it presented in his Vitae. Kerbsky is a different matter. He tends to be the dominant source. He was a commander of Russian troops in Livonia during the war, entered into a conspiracy with the Polish king at the time, Sigismund, and betrayed Russia during the hostilities. He defected to Poland, bringing his forces with him. He received a reward. He had lands and serfs in Lithuania. Not only that, later on, he personally commanded military operations against Russia in that very same war. He destroyed Orthodox churches, the Polish-Lithuanian and Tatar detachments that he commanded. He doesn't deny it in his letters back and forth to the Tsar. Interesting correspondence, by the way. It's difficult to hold him as an objective source whatsoever. He was sharply negative towards the Tsar, but at the time of Philip's death, he lived in another country. Clearly, The Vitae Metropolitan Philip was written by an opponent of Tsar Ivan after his death. It contains many factual errors. Skirinkov says maybe 1590s at Solovetsky. None of the authors were eyewitnesses to the events. They used living witnesses. People like the elder Simeon, former bailiff Kolichev, Solovetsky monks, who traveled to Moscow during the trial of Philip in his favor. So the Vitae came from the monks who slandered him. Slanderous testimony played a decisive role in his condemnation. And the former bailiff, Simeon Koblin, who guarded Philip at the monastery and failed to fulfill his duties, he may have been involved in the murder. Anyone who looks at these sources are going to find a lot of problems, factual errors, conceptual errors. One tells how the Tsar sent the severed head of his brother, Mikhail, to St. Philip, who had already been removed from his position, but was still in Moscow. But Mikhail Kolichev died in 1571, 3 years after the events described. He gives a detailed account of the conversation between one of Ivan's guards, Maluta, and St. Philip, claiming that Maluta killed Philip on the orders of Ivan. But the authors of the text say that no one witnessed what happened between them. So where is this detailed conversation coming from? The severed head story, which is ridiculous. Other additions, the brother Mikhail is replaced by a nephew of Philip. In later versions of the Vitae, published for the common folk, there's all of these additions that distort everything, usually coming straight from Kerbsky's works. It's very hard to separate fact from fiction here. George Fedotov, who was no fan of Ivan the Terrible, he wrote the book on Philip of Moscow. He emphasizes that the speech of St. Philip, quote, is precious to us not as an exact record of the words of the saint, but as an ideal dialogue, since it does not have the character of authenticity. The compilers of the life of St. Philip point out those who ordered the slander against Philip, and they name them. The accomplices of malice, Pimen of Novgorod especially, Paphnutius of Suzdal, Philotheus of Ryazan, and Eustathius, who was, I think, the cell attendant. The whisperer, as it says, against St. Philip before the monarchy. Eustathius incessantly, openly, secretly carried speeches inappropriate for the Tsar to Philip. In the life of Archbishop Pimen, says that he was the first hierarch of the Russian church after the Metropolitan who dreamed of seizing the throne. There was an entire cabal within the church of destroying Philip. Opponents of Ivan, by the way. They had a false council, according to Kartashev, became the most shameful of all Robert councils that have occurred through Russian church history. Fedotov is no, he again, Philip, Metropolitan of Moscow, YMCA Press, I have the English edition, 1924. He does have tremendous prejudice against Ivan, but he still said, it fell to the holy confessor to drink the whole cup of bitterness, to be condemned not by the tyrants, but by the council of the Russian church and slandered by his own spiritual children. The names of those who had an interest in killing him are well known. The Tsar, at worst, was deceived. Those who were constantly slandering Philip to him, the men I just mentioned, many of them eventually were exiled. St. Dmitry of Rostov, who was very famous for his text of the Menaeon, doesn't mention that the Tsar was in any way involved in the death of the Metropolitan. Kerbsky pointed out, of all people, that the Tsar, as if he had sent to him Metropolitan Philip, and asked for his blessing as well as for his return to the throne. He asked for him to come back. Sources here testifying the murder of St. Philip, at best, were compiled from hearsay. They have an aversion to Tsar Ivan and the monarchy in general, and they repeat a lot of unsubstantiated rumors. The facts that we do know trial of the saint, his defrocking, exile, and martyrdom. Now that's all real. But that Tsar Ivan did it, or someone did it on his orders, there is no foundation for it. There is no reason that Tsar Ivan could hate Metropolitan Philip at any level for any reason. So much so that he would order him, or, you know, who was already in exile, to be strangled, without including his name, by the way, in the memorial synodicon, as he always did. There are no reasons for this. But the synodicon of Ivan IV has a list of those who he ordered killed. You do have representatives of the clergy there. The monk Afonia, the monk Nikita Kazinov, a nun Euphrosyne, monk Amos, archimandrite of the caves, Cornelius and Vassian, Dorothy, Afon, Dionysius. Between 1567 and 1570. Now, those guys were executed during the investigation of the Novgorod treason case. Now, there was no question that Ivan hated having to execute clergy. And it was only for the most serious crimes, treason or attempted assassination. Of everyone listed in the Synodicon, members of the clergy are less than 1%. Metropolitan Philip's name is not there. There is no way to explain why he's not there. If he had recorded all these monks there, he certainly would have recorded the Metropolitan. As I said, Ivan and Philip were friends since childhood. The Tsar himself chose Philip, who was abbot of Solovyetsky, and elevated him, or, you know, recommended him to the See of Moscow in 1566. Now, historians, make-believe historians, will cite Philip's harsh criticism of the Tsar as the main reason. But there was really no criticism as such. You have to interpret Philip's words that way. But his words don't contain much criticism. Usually they say that Philip spoke out against the Opochina and called for others to rise against it. But the famous Metropolitan John of Lagoda, he says, if we're talking about a strictly scientific approach, then there's no evidence at all that the numerous accusatory speeches of the Metropolitan cited in the various vitae were ever made by him. I mean, after all, criticism is a trivial offense. Trash-talking, essentially, especially under those conditions. So, in the Novgorod treason case, the instigator of this, Archbishop Piemann, the organizer and leader of this conspiracy, he was only exiled. So why would Philip be killed? I mentioned, of the 300 people, only a handful ultimately ended up being executed, even of those convicted. 180 were released. Yes, there was a problem in the relationship, but it wasn't on Philip's side or the Tsar's side. It came from the outside. A group of men for whom the death of Metropolitan Philip was beneficial. As I already mentioned, the main one was Novgorod's Bishop Piemann, who wanted to take Philip's place. The Tsar's confessor, Eustathius, played a major role. He didn't like the good relations between the Tsar and Philip. He was afraid of losing the Tsar's favor. And Paphnutius, the bishop of Suzdal, Philotheus of Rezan. Now, what did these guys do? They were connected with the treason trial. They were connected with the boyars. They wanted power and influence. And what they did was lie. They lied to the Tsar, but the Metropolitan, and slandered Philip about the Tsar. Now, they couldn't have these two men meet. There had to be a pretext for the removal of Philip. The Tsar managed to convince Philip, contrary to his promise, was trying to interfere in the sovereign's affairs, which he did not. So this group of men had to go to Solovyansky, where he had been the abbot. They needed to find whatever evidence they could, and the new abbot, Paisios, was promised an episcopal see if he testified against the Metropolitan. The charges were very vague. No serious offense could be found. So they invented something about his life in the monastery that no one ever mentioned before. There was a trial. Very much confused, Ivan. The Metropolitan was already old. He was removed from his see and sent into retirement. There was no wrath, no anger of the sovereign in any source. But during the Oprichnina campaign against Novgorod, Metropolitan Philip, now in exile, was dangerous not for the Tsar, but for Archbishop Pammon, who had already signed the document with the other conspirators on the transfer of Novgorod under the authority of King Sigismund of Poland. He signed that document to hand it over to the Catholics and to become a Catholic himself. During the investigation, Pimmon's connections with the Moscow oligarch supporting the Judaizers, involved in the conspiracy, it could be revealed. That's one of the reasons that Philip had to be removed. Malutia Skuratov, I mentioned him already, one of the Tsar's bodyguards. Yes, he was sent to Metropolitan Philip's, probably for some information about the Novgorod affair, but he was dead when he got there. And the Menaean, the Day of the Memory of St. Philip, says that all the culprits of his execution fell under the terrible disgrace of the Tsar. And Solovyetsky Monastery suffered especially from where the false witnesses came. Now, Paisios was exiled to Vlam, not having received his coveted episcopal see. When the saint was appointed metropolitan in 1566, the same group of men asked the Tsar to appease his anger at Philip. And he said, "I'm not angry at Philip." They invented it. And he started to get very suspicious. He wanted more than anything to see Philip, a man he's known since childhood, renowned for his honesty and holiness, to be metropolitan of all Russia. And Philip didn't really want it. The Fyodorov-Chelyabin conspiracy was exposed in 1567. The metropolitan came out in favor of the Tsar state policy and publicly denounced the bishops who sympathized with the conspirators. That means that this cabal, that any new conspiracy would not be successful. Because even in the event of Tsar Ivan's murder, traitors would have to face the metropolitan. That's one of the reasons he had to be removed. So they started off with basic slander, separating the saint and the Tsar. They used the Tsar's confessor, as I mentioned, who openly and secretly made speeches against Philip. They lied to Philip about Ivan. But the problem is they didn't realize that at the time of his approval as metropolitan, the Tsar and the metropolitan had already laid out their spheres of influence in writing in 1566. One did not interfere in church governance, the other didn't touch state affairs. So when they would talk about Philip being, you know, involved in state affairs or being a conspirator or hating Ivan for some weird reason, he didn't believe them. He demanded facts, which of course they didn't have. So Novgorod, Ryazan, Suzdal, the bishops entered into alliance with a defecting member of the Oprichnina. The boyars Alexei and Fyodor Basmanov joined the campaign. It was a commission headed by Paphnutius. This Oprichnik was Prince Temkin Mostovsky, sent to the Solovetsky Monastery to search for evidence I've already mentioned. Paisius promised this see. There was a lot of bribes, there was a lot of intimidation. And again, that's where in 1568 the Robert Council was convened. By the way, the verdict of that council has mysteriously disappeared. But the speech of Pimen, who had become a metropolitan in Novgorod at the time, fiercely denounced Philip. The Tsar did not interfere with the decisions of the council, and Philip's opponents had to appeal to the Tsar themselves. Ivan was scrupulous about conscientiously observing the signed agreement on their delimitation of the spheres of activity. The Tsar protected Philip, but he didn't know if this synod was real or not. He had no reason to think it was fake. And Philip wanted to go anyway. He was arrested, ultimately, by Alexei Basmanov. He was imprisoned at the Osroch Monastery in Tver under the supervision of Stefan Kobylin, who I mentioned already. Philotheus was defrocked. That same Kobylin was exiled. The Basmanovs were executed, as well as Prince Tenkin Rostovsky, due to the inept defense of Moscow in 1571. Pimen himself was imprisoned in the Nikolsky Monastery. Didn't kill him. Well, if Pimen of Novgorod wasn't executed, then Philip wasn't. Pimen did not become the head of the church in Russia. Ivan wasn't stupid. He called for St. Philip of Troitsk to be replaced by an abbot Kirill. In September 1569, an investigation began into the connections between Moscow and Novgorod traitors and their participation in the elimination of Philip. Philip then became a dangerous witness, and that's why he had to be killed. Ivan needed him alive and had absolutely no reason whatsoever. These pompous speeches of Philip condemning Ivan have no basis in reality. Today, you know, it's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, you have many scholars who say, okay, we know it's not real. The murder of Philip, assuming that it was a murder, that broke Ivan. That was the last straw. He moved towards Novgorod. As I mentioned before, they called it the Novgorod pogrom. Even Karl Marx mentioned it. Writings came from the fabrications of Kerbsky, Staden, the spy, and Taub and Cruz. Only Staden was actually there. Horsey, in his memoirs, tries to claim that there was a pogrom there, you know, not a Jewish one, but, you know, a mass killing. The claim was that Ivan, allegedly retreating from Rival, September 1558, avenged his defeat and plunders first Narva, then pardons Pskov, and finally brings 30,000 Tartars and 10,000 riflemen to Novgorod and murders 700,000 people. Okay? In all 150 cities of Russia at the time, there probably aren't 700,000 people there in cities totally. Moscow had about 100,000 people. Novgorod had about, 26,000 residents. He couldn't have killed 700,000. Kolomna even had 3,200. These weren't huge places. Even the Novgorod treason case, many of these documents, they have survived the time of troubles, but they disappeared sometime in the 19th century. As did, by the way, the Charter of the Opochina, as well as the verdict against Philip. So what happened in Novgorod? Well, there couldn't have been 15,000 troops from the Opochina, as Zimin says. They never exceeded 5,000. And of that 5,000, you know, you had 500 who were the personal guard, 1,200 were courtiers. Kostomarov, the great Ukrainian historian, speaks vaguely about this army, saying that there was only 500 men. Vasilevsky actually says that. Well, Zawiski says, oh, it's not 700,000, it's 70,000. Karamzin, of all people, says 800,000 burned in Moscow, and Kostomarov, 80,000. Well, there weren't 15,000 in the entire organization. He had about 1,500 of his most trusted men, probably the best that he can do. 1,000 were the advanced detachment under Skuratov, and 500 guarded the Tsar. There was no Tartars, there was no riflemen. You had people at the time and later building on this story. Ivan never stormed the Novgorod strongholds. The advanced detachment arrested noble citizens, oligarchs, I should say, those specifically who had signatures on the treaty with Sigismund. Monks were guilty of the Judaizing heresy and supporting the Polish move. They served as the ideological support for the separatism of Novgorod, very important Russian Orthodox part of the empire. And a trial took place when Ivan finally got there. Even the Pskov Chronicle says 60,000. And the Chronicles can't possibly be true. 30,000. The Novgorod Chronicle says, even though it's 5,000 more than the population of the whole city, Taliban crews say 15,000 were executed, that they were killed on the banks of the Volga. Kursky says it's 5,000 were killed in one day. Soviet historian Skrinnikov says the most would be 1,505. The same number, by the way, 1,500, are listed. Messages for Ivan, prayerful commemoration at the monastery. So that's something probably closer to the truth. People talk about 5,000 ruined households out of 6,000 in Novgorod. 10,000 corpses that were found in August of 1570 in a mass grave near the Nativity Church there. And the desolation of the Novgorod lands. What could this possibly be? Well, they forget something. 1569, 1571, the Black Plague struck Russia. The western and northwestern regions, including Novgorod, suffered had about 300,000 possible deaths from the infection. Had about 500 a day in Moscow. By the way, the exact same number that Ivan allegedly executed daily in Novgorod. The victims of the plague, they were buried near the Novgorod Nativity Church. The fact is, the dead were taken to the mass grave all summer, definitely in summer, but the funeral service was held for them only in August. So at first, the victims of the Opochino regime were searched for in the surrounding areas, taken to a burial ground without a funeral service, buried, and after 7 months, they decided to correct the mistake and hold a funeral service? The plague makes a lot more sense. Those dying from the plague were buried quickly, so they, you know, the microbe couldn't spread. You couldn't do the burial service right away. And there were plenty of clergy who died as well. Well, summer of 1570, that's exactly what happened. Even Karamzin says so. But he says hunger and disease completed the executions of Ivan. It's significant that precisely the people who died from the plague, that people like Kobrin most shamelessly attributes to the tyrant, not paying attention to the fact that they died several months after Ivan's departure from Novgorod. There was no pogrom in Pskov, however. A very similar political situation existed there, too. There, I think, writers like Zimin say that there were two executed in Pskov, Cornelius and Vassian. There were a few others after the trial in different parts of the country, but they were stopped by the holy fool, Nikola. Nicholas of Pskov was a holy saint. Now, it's sometimes when a foreigner writes vile things about a Russian saint, the people like Horsey, at least, admits that he witnessed miracles performed by this holy fool. When Kostomarov blasphemously mocks him, well, now Basil the Blessed, the famous Moscow holy fool, visited the Tsar, did not hesitate to accuse him of many things. This man died in the Tsar's arms, having predicted to him that the Russian state would be inherited not by the eldest son, but the youngest, Fyodor. Well, the holy fools mouthed off at Ivan all the time. He executed very few people when you compare it to the executions of Western Europe or of Peter in the 18th century. So I think I don't know if the U.S. executes more people than Ivan did yearly. I'm not sure. I want to repeat that Philip had refused the rank of Metropolitan for Ivan. He said that, I'm too old, I'm too weak. But the Tsar insisted that he be placed there. There was a tremendous outcry from the Synod and the Tsar that he be installed as Metropolitan. But Ivan had the foresight to draw up a document laying out the areas where each can comment on. It's right in the charter, not to intervene in the Opochina, in the Tsar's domestic affairs after appointment, not to leave the Metropolitanate because of the Opochina or the Tsar's domestic affairs. That means the point was to protect him, to take him out of the palace intrigues, and deprive the boyars of the opportunity to even demand his removal. the Tsar personally held or gave the pastoral staff, which used to belong to St. Peter, not the apostle, but the Russian saint. Philip and Ivan were of one mind in terms of political matters. St. Philip tried to imitate Metropolitan Maconius, his predecessor, who Ivan also loved very much. It was an excellent example of symphony, but unbearable for those who saw their high position not as a basis for increased service, but for justification for their passions. The Novgorod trials are something, again, that come up when you study Ivan. I just was glancing through websites, and just it's very hard to do. The Novgorod slaughter, the Novgorod mass murders. Yes, Metropolitan Philip did want them, those convicted, when the document that they all signed, the rebel sign was discovered. He denounced them. Now, those words, he said, no rank in this world will save us from eternal torment if we transgress the commandment of Christ and forget our duty to care for the piety of the faithful Tsar and for the peace and prosperity of the Orthodox. Talking about these trials, he said, is this what you've gathered for, fathers and brothers, to remain silent, afraid to utter the truth? Now, those words are taken to mean that he was opposing the Opichnina. There is no hint there. They quote him completely, literally. One time, the out-of-context thing actually works. The context had nothing to do with the Opichnina whatsoever. Philip never. They take these things, they take a line here and a line there and make it seem like he was attacking Ivan. And he didn't. Clergy criticized Ivan the Terrible all the time. Metropolitan knew. Philip was well aware. He said, I see my impending end. Do you know why they want to expel me from here, meaning my see, and incite Ivan against me? Because I did not flatter them. However, whatever happens, I will not stop telling the truth. But I do not bear the rank of Metropolitan in vain. It simply wasn't working. They didn't find any incriminating evidence. What they found was so weak they couldn't do anything with it. Yeah, it was a show trial, as far as anyone knows. But Ivan didn't really know that. Ivan had made it very clear he's not going to interfere with these synods. It was impossible to convince the Tsar of Philip's unreliability. So actually, it wasn't until 1568 Philip was removed from the Metropolitan's see. He was sent to retire to Moscow Monastery, St. Nicholas. The Tsar ordered some money to be sent to him for his upkeep. Ivan also, like Philip, understood everything. What Philip said was perfectly legitimate, and Ivan was even more liberal than he was. That would not have been the case had people like Pim and others taken over. So as his reign drew to an end, long reign, the Livonian War had drained the country, this is very true, deprived Russia of lands and won the Baltics. But, on the other hand, he annexed vast expanses of Siberia from 1579 to 1584. Russia had been purified and renewed by the Opichnina. The relapses, the Judaizers were eradicated in Novgorod and Pskov. The church was organized. The Tsar died in peace in 1584. In the last hours of his earthly life, his wish came true. Metropolitan Dionysius tonsured him. And no longer Tsar Ivan IV, but he was a humble monk Jonah. That's what appeared before the supreme judge whose service he had dedicated his stormy and difficult life. And that's a lot of words to say that Ivan didn't kill many people. And he most certainly didn't kill Philip, his ally, his nonstop ally. Just shows you the corruption that had already entered the church at this point. and what happens when oligarchy is allowed even the slightest grasp of power. Thank you, everyone, for listening again. Christ has risen, my friends. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.